So today we're going to start by just finishing up a couple things related to this foliation of space-time. And then we're going to spend most of the day basically decomposing the Einstein equations basically into parts that are kind of on these leaves or slices of space-time and then perpendicular to it. So last class we mentioned this foliation of space-time, and associated with that we have our unit normal, two slices of constant time. Just by definition, that's the normal to a slice of constant time, and this kappa is just defined by our normalization condition. We've seen that several times before. But now, just to introduce some terminology associated with this unit normal, if we write in components, it's just going to have lower indices, it's just going to have a time component. And we're going to call this factor here the lapse. If you want to calculate that in terms of the metric components, you can just use this here or raise here and lower here, in which case we have. This or which means that the lapse is just given by this quantity in terms of the inverse metric. And then we can raise the unit normal so it has upper indices and write it this way. And this three vector here, we're calling the shift vector. And again, if we want to explicitly calculate that in terms of the metric, this. So we can kind of think of this unit normal as defining the four velocity of some observer that's moving perpendicular to our slices of constant time. And in that sense, we can think of the lapse is going to be sort of the d tau, where tau is kind of the proper time associated with this fiducial set of observers, and then the coordinate time, and then minus the shift would sort of be the coordinate velocity associated with this fiducial set of observers defined with respect to this slicing of space-time. So that's just some terminology there.
What does the term fiducial mean?
Or I'm just saying, that we've just chosen some coordinates, There's no sort of unique way to slice space-time. Just associated with that, there are some, we can make up some observers that would be defined with respect to that coordinate slicing.
So observers defined based on the coordinate slicing.
Yeah, so I mean, we don't necessarily have to think of these as physical. But I mean, as long as this is a time-like vector future pointing, then it has, since we already normalized it, then there could be some observer with that.
So it means with respect to this slicing, those observers are stationary. They're moving in the direction of just t, right?
Yeah, they're moving perpendicular to the,
Perpendicular to the tangent.
yeah. But in terms of coordinates, I mean, you can see that they are changing their coordinate position if you have this non-zero shift. Yeah, and then closely related to this unit normal is the evolution operator. And we're just defining that to be the lapse times the unit normal. And the evolution operator has the property that that this is true. Or sort of geometrically, you know, if we think of, or so given this property, if we have our time coordinate, you know, defined as a function of our, some point p on our space-time manifold, and we want to see how it changes when we deform some delta t away, then this evolution operator is basically the one that generates that. So sort of geometrically, we can think of it as we have some time slice here, and then you want to go to the next time slice, some delta t away. And to get from one to the other, you take this m vector and multiply it by delta t. You'll notice it is parallel to the unit normal. So last lecture, I also mentioned that the extrinsic curvature, which we introduced to define the curvature associated with some slice as it's embedded in four-dimensional spacetime, I said that that could also be sort of interpreted as determining the evolution of the three metric as you go from one slice to the next. So we'll return that point right now. So we can calculate the Lie derivative with respect to this unit normal of our metric, or our three metric. That's just the definition of the Lie derivative. And we can use basically the fact that this covariant derivative act on a three metric, recall from last time that basically this has a four metric part and then just the unit normal part. So the first part goes to zero, the metric compatibility at this. We use that, and then we're also going to use another fact from last lecture, which is that this quantity is basically our definition of, or the expression we got for the extrinsic curvature when we extended it to the four-dimensional spacetime. And recall that we call this the acceleration, and that's actually tangent to the slice of constant time. So basically, we plug in these two things here, bring through a little algebra, and we get a nice simple expression. Or if we want to write it in terms of this evolution operator M, at that. You notice that's because the extra terms they would get from here to here going in the in direction, so they cancel out. So what this means is basically as we evolve the three metric with respect to time, the extrinsic curvature basically exactly tells you how it's going to change. But just a note, so far we're still not doing any physics, so this is kind of a purely kinematical or geometric relationship. All right. Okay, so any questions about that before we move on to actually doing some physics? Sort of our goal today is going to be take the Einstein equations, and then we're going to project them into components that are perpendicular to time slices and tangent are and contained within the time slice. And the equations are going to be kind of messy, not that complicated, but you know, a lot of indices flying around. I'm not going to go through all the algebra, but I mean, if you're interested in kind of every single step of the algebra, you can work out for yourself, or also just check out those Gorgonian lecture notes that I gave the archive number for last time, also on the syllabus. So before we actually write down the Einstein equations, we're basically going to need to project the four-dimensional Riemann tensor into all the different components on the time slice and tangent to it. So let's start with the definition of the three Riemann tensor. So it's just the exact same as the 4-1, except we use the three-dimensional covariant derivatives here. And if we can basically rewrite the right-hand side in terms of the four-dimensional covariant derivatives. So you'll call from last time, just basically need to project everything, these projection operators. So just have to basically substitute this in for here, and then same thing here, switching the indices, and also use the fact that the three-dimensional metric can be written in terms of the four-dimensional one, plus this term involving the unit normal. And then again, apply basically that equation. So if you do sort of combine those three things, crank through the algebra, then you get the following. All right. And then we can just take this equation and start contracting. So just contract the C with the A. And take one of these terms to the right-hand side. Let's call this equation diamond. Name that one. And we can keep contracting one more time. Just contract these two indices together. Get the three-dimensional Ricci scalar. We get a k squared there. Call this one star. Need that one too. Okay. So then we need to basically apply the same kind of substitutions. This time we'll write down the four-dimensional Riemann tensor, and contract it with one n. All right, so we get that. So the one unit normal and then three of the gamma projection operators. Basically, you know, applying like this trick and that trick, get that. We can also contract that one time with C equals to A. And then we get
second, is that still the four Riemann tensor? Is we projected out, or we are just multiplying stuff? Gamma.
These are all, this is the four-dimensional Riemann tensor, four-dimensional Ricci tensor. Yeah. Yeah, so you notice we're kind of collecting all the four-dimensional stuff with the projections on one side, here and here, and three-dimensional stuff here. Yep. And let's call this one smiley face. equation. We'll need that one too. So these relations, just for some terminology, are sometimes called the Gauss-Kadachi equations. All right, so far we have expressions for basically the Riemann tensor with 4 times the projection operator. That was here. Then we have it with 3 projection operators and 1 unit normal. And now we just need to do it with 2 gamma projection operators and 2 unit normals. And then we'll be done. So if you contract it with 3 unit normals, then you can use the anti-symmetry to determine that just goes to 0. All right, so one more. So we just have the Riemann tensor contracted with 1 unit normal, and then we did it with 2 projection operators and 1 unit normal. So then if we plug in this guy right here, and we can actually rewrite this acceleration operator in terms of the laps. Then we get the following.
How did we get that?
It takes a little bit of algebra, but
this is just trying to.
Yeah, I mean, it's just basically plugging in the definition of unit normal in terms of the collapse. Yeah. So once we crank through everything, we should get this. All right, and if we kind of rewrite now in terms of the evolution operator, then we get this. Thank you. And let's call that one triangle. Yeah, so I just rewrote that term in terms of this. Okay, so now we're really ready to switch to physics. Let's write down the Einstein equations. So if we have matter, we're going to start projecting this left-hand side with our projection operators and unit normals and use all the equations we derived. But we also need to sort of introduce some terminology associated with the stress energy tensor and its space-time decomposition. So let me just do that first. So the first thing is the energy density. And that's just stress energy tensor with two unit normals. Then there's what's called the momentum density. That's one projection operator and one unit normal. And then there's basically the spatial components. So that's the matter stress tensor. And just to give you a little bit of intuition for this, or actually, I'm going to write one more one, which is just the trace of the stress energy tensor T in terms of these guys is going to be S minus. So just to give some intuition for this, let's recall the stress energy tensor for a fluid. So it's the energy density plus the pressure, and the four velocity, and then the pressure times the four metric. So if we apply that decomposition to this particular stress energy tensor, we get that the energy is going to be this quantity. So in particular, if you have if you're just at, well, yeah, let me define what I mean for W first. I'll come back to this. So four momentum is this. SAB is this. Okay, and here I introduced this W, which is basically the Lorentz factor. Associated with the four velocity, as measured by the observer this fiducial observer that's perpendicular to slices of constant time. And here, these are capital U's, most of these lowercase ones. And that's just the what's sometimes called the Eulerian three velocity. Which is, again, what you measure for this four velocity when you project onto your slices. Yeah, so you can see that, you know, energy density for kind of at rest, this Lorentz factor will just be one, so we'll just have the plain energy density. But if we're, you know, if the fluid is moving, there's some extra, you know, kinetic energy associated with that. And this forward momentum indeed points in the direction of this Eulerian velocity. And then this tensor is kind of the same as this tensor, but directing to just basically the spatial components in this. Okay, so any questions about that? All right, so let's go back to, so now that we have all the stuff for the right-hand side, let's project the left-hand side of this. All right, so basically if we set both sides with two unit normals, and then we have an erase that we apply a star here. So this equation is called the Hamiltonian constraint. And so you'll notice that it just involves, you know, quantities you can calculate in terms of the extrinsic curvature and the intrinsic curvature. And in particular, it doesn't involve any sort of second time derivatives of the metric. It does involve second spatial derivatives, right? Because this three-dimensional Ricci scalar will involve second spatial derivatives of the three metric. But it's basically just determined by the slice. And it also doesn't involve this lapse and shift either. And so actually this is the equation that sort of is most closely related to like the Poisson equation from Newtonian gravity. If you take the non-relativistic limit of that with the Poisson equation. And also, if you consider a homogeneous space-time, this is the one that will give you, I think, the first Riemann equation for a homogeneous cosmology. Okay, so we did two ends. So now we can also do one projection operator and one end. Okay, and this term, of course, when you project this, you get zero. Get rid of that, and we just need this equation right here, smiley face. And this one is called the momentum constraint. And for obvious reasons. And again, you'll see that it just involves sort of quantities that are determined by a particular spatial slice, and it doesn't involve sort of second and derivatives of the metric. All right, so any questions about that? Okay, so now we just need to project the Einstein equations one more time. So this time I'm going to write them down in trace reversed form. Let's just take the trace of the Einstein equations. Subtract, basically get rid of the 1 minus r times gav term and replace it with the stress energy term. So start with that. And then we're going to apply the projection operator gamma twice to this. And to evaluate this left-hand side, we're going to need the diamond equation and triangle. Hopefully I haven't erased there. We have that, and then we'll write out this thing again, but the matter equations on the right hand side. So we can kind of think of this as an evolution operator for our extrinsic curvature, right? Just put this on one end side and put everything else on the other side. So we can think of, we start with some initial data, one time slice, basically our matter fields and our three metric and our extrinsic curvature. And then we can calculate all of these quantities and know how the extrinsic curvature evolves. And if you recall, we basically already had an evolution equation for our three metric. That was this one, probably up there somewhere. Yeah, this is the one that doesn't really have any physics. So basically, now we sort of have all the equations we need to start with some initial data. and then calculate them in the next time, and then so on, and keep evolving through all our, basically map out all the slices of our space-time. So you notice that these two equations do involve the lapse and shift. Both here and implicitly in this M evolution operator. So we can kind of think of the four coordinate degrees of freedom that you have, given by the fact that you have this diffeomorphism invariance of our space-time manifold as being encoded by four degrees of freedom set by your lapse and then three shift components. So in addition, these equations, you also need to specify either explicitly what the lapse and shift is as you evolve, or some evolution equations also for your lapse and shift. And this is basically how you would choose your coordinate degrees of freedom that you have freedom to choose. But so there's another thing that might occur to you, which is I just said that we have these two evolution equations that'll basically tell us what our extrinsic curvature and three metric are for all time. But then I also wrote down these equations which need to be satisfied. Right? So we might worry that we're kind of overdetermining our system. These force us to have some values. How do we know for sure that they'll solve the momentum and Hamiltonian constraints later?
Here, what we are saying is that, means in terms of the degrees of freedom that we were counting, is that means it's like if we choose our lapse and shift, we are fixing the gauge or something like that.
Yeah.
In the four degrees of freedom, the diffeomorphism invariance, we fix gauge by choosing some particular.
So exactly.
If we choose alpha and beta, we are fixing the gauge.
Yeah. Because there are several different ways that one can choose these gauge degrees of freedom. So one way would be to just write down some equation for the lapse and shift. Like, for example, the simplest one would be what's called geodesic slicing. So it'd be, say, lapse is always 1, shift is always 0. Turns out that's not a great gauge that it can develop coordinate singularities, but it's certainly a valid one. But you could also just have some evolution equation for your lapse and shift. Or we'll talk about in a few lectures some other ways of picking these coordinate degrees of freedom. Yeah, but basically you have 4 degrees, and that's one way to specify them. Yeah, so it actually turns out that if we choose some initial data that's initially satisfies these Hamiltonian momentum constraints at some time slice, that the evolution equations will guarantee that at some later time will still satisfy these constraints. I'm going to kind of briefly sketch the idea of that, but we'll come back to this sort of explicitly writing out the evolution equations for the constraint when we talk about sort of a different formulation for Einstein equations called the generalized harmonic formulation. Roughly the idea of this constraint propagation. So let's call EAB basically the Einstein equation. So when this is 0, Einstein equations hold. So here this Einstein tensor minus 8 pi times the stress energy tensor. And, you know, roughly the constraints in this language are that this is equal to zero. So basically the, you know, roughly speaking, the Hamiltonian constraint is the TT component, and the momentum one is the TI component, the Einstein equations. So if we take the, if we apply a four-dimensional covariant derivative to this EAB tensor, then we just get this. So this is going to be zero by the Bianchi identity. And this will be zero as long as we satisfy stress energy conservation. And so basically we have that this is zero, you know, even before we apply the Einstein equations. So we can kind of think of this roughly as that we can take this, put this on the left-hand side, and then on the other side we have terms involving just the Einstein equations and spatial gradients of them. So basically this means that if we initially satisfy the constraints, which are kind of the T and A component of the Einstein equations, then we also satisfy stress energy conservation and the spatial parts of the Einstein equations, and then just plugging that in will give you zero on this right-hand side. And that means that the constraints will sort of propagate. They'll continue to be satisfied at some later time. So that was a little bit of a rough proof, but we'll explicitly write down the propagation of the constraints in a different form later.
Could you repeat? Means our constraints are NA, something like NA EAB. So what you're saying is that if in the initial data we satisfy that, then yeah. How is that relating to that last equation?
So I'm saying like this equals zero, like before we apply the Einstein equations, we can kind of rewrite it as like something like the evolution of the TA component with time is going to involve terms that will just be the regular Einstein equations, and then the just like spatial gradients of it, right? And so that kind of means that if we have some solution where we're requiring it basically this means if we initially satisfy the constraints and the spatial components of the Einstein equations, then our constraints will propagate, that the time derivative of these constraints will be zero. Like if they're initially satisfied, then they won't change.
It's not clear. This is like a rough idea, something like it's not very intuitive to me.
Okay, yeah. So maybe it'll be clearer. In a couple of lectures, we'll write down this propagation of the constraints. We'll do it for the generalized harmonic. And if you want to see specifically the equations that it satisfies for these 3+1 quantities, you can also see those notes. So maybe also just a kind of analogy what will help. So we can think of another system of equations that also you can divide into constraint equations and evolution equations. That's the Maxwell equations. It was actually kind of completely analogous to this here. for the Maxwell equations, we have the two constraints. If the divergence of the E field is the charge density, and that our B field is divergenceless. And then we have two evolution equations. So again, you know, it may seem like our system is overdetermined because we can start with some initial conditions that satisfy this. But then how do we know, since we are, our B and E fields are already determined by these equations, how do we know they won't evolve to something that will violate this? So again, you can just sort of you know, take the divergence of these two equations and then we get this for the B field using the fact that the divergence of the kernel is zero. And then for the E field, we get this. And so, you know, just like we need stress energy conservation, not violate the constraints, in this case, we need the charge conservation. We just plug that in, then we get that zero. So just for this guy, I plugged in minus the time derivative of rho, and then that's this term right here. So this term is this term. Take this term to the other side and switch out this guy for that guy and get this one.
Oh, I see. Just
yeah. So this, and then this is the constraint equation. So basically, it's zero initially. Then find root is zero. Okay, so any other questions about that? So I think that there's actually no more lectures for the rest of the week. You guys get a little bit of break, love tutorials. And then we'll start back again Monday at 9 a.m. A week from now. And I think that'll actually be a guest lecture by Louise Lehner, and he'll talk a little bit about what it means to be for an evolution system to be well-posed. And then after that, we'll introduce sort of well-posed formulation of the Einstein equations.